You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When you see that something on a menu has been braised, doesn't it immediately strike you as sounding succulent and also somewhat mysterious? Well, Michael Ruhlman joins us now to reveal some of the secrets of this important cooking technique. The James Beard Award-winning writer has come back to our show to discuss his latest book called Ruhlman's How to Braise. It's just been published by Little Brown and Company. And even though braising may soon be less mysterious, let's hope that it will turn out to be even more exciting. Welcome back to our show, Michael.
Happy to be here.
You admit early on here that braising is your favorite of all fundamental cooking techniques?
Yes, because it truly transforms food. When we grill a steak, we're just heating that steak. It's still steak when it goes in and goes on the grill and comes out. When we braise, we transform a tough, often inexpensive cut of meat and transform it into something succulent and rich.
But we're mostly doing it with meat?
Mostly with meat, yeah.
Because the move for a lot of people right now is to having a more vegetable-based diet, even if they eat meat.
These are good, usually offcuts to eat, the shank of an animal, say. But cabbage and fennel are great to braise, too. Braising is a technique that tenderizes.
What does the term braising actually mean?
You know, it's funny because people don't really, you know, they like, I know it when I see it kind of thing. My definition of braise is that food is first seared in dry heat and then cooked in moisture until tender. That's what braise means.
So it requires being cooked in an oven, at least for part of the process.
You can braise on the stovetop, technically. You can grill a pork shoulder and then braise it. That could be your searing technique.
And then there's a liquid covering the whatever you're braising
sometimes,
after you do that initial searing?
Yeah, there's always liquid in the vessel, so it's either steamy around it or it's actually covered in the liquid.
How does a braise differ from a stew?
They're very similar. Stew is a form of braise. You take smaller chunks of meat and cook them till they're tender.
What if you steam the meat after you sear it? Is it still a braise?
Because it's in moist heat, I would say that still is a braise, yes.
Can people be intimidated by braising because it can require a number of different steps?
I would hope that they wouldn't. It's not that difficult, and technically you don't even have to do the searing part. That adds flavor and color and does make things better, and you're more a part of the cooking process.
It gives you a little crust initially,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's flavor. And so your liquid, it becomes the sauce, is more flavorful.
You say that the first thing you should do when you're cooking meat is to salt it. Are we talking about the equivalent of koshering meat?
No, not quite. Just season. I always season meat ahead of cooking. It's just standard practice. It's less important in braising because a lot of that salt will leach out into the cooking liquid. So it's more important probably to season the liquid that it's cooking in than the meat itself.
Pepper as well, I assume.
Pepper for flavor.
And what does the salt do? Well, the salt, as you say, leaches out some of the flavor when you're doing braising because you have this liquid that. It's
the liquid that leaches out the flavor. The salt adds depth of flavor.
Isn't it true that the only thing you need to season with a braise is the liquid then?
You could make that argument, yes.
What happens if you oversalt a braise?
Oversalting is tricky. You either have to add more liquid or more meat. It's very hard to get rid of excess salt. Some people try putting in potatoes. You know, add more food.
Uh-huh. Well, that is a problem that I've sometimes even done to myself without meaning to. I think that I only put it in a reasonable amount, and the next thing I know, I have something that's really salty.
Mm-hmm.
But there aren't always other things to put in. So would sugar ever counteract it?
I don't think sugar would counteract it. Fat counteracts it. Adding some cream or butter would counteract it.
What makes a good braising liquid? Are we talking about anything that's wet? Wine, I guess, beer, stock? What about water?
Water's great. It pulls out. Water is a great extractor. It extracts flavor. So as long as you pack that braise full of aromatic vegetables and the meat, you can use water. But you can use wine. You can use beer, cider, tomato sauce, and there are any number of braised mediums.
But you advocate using a smaller pot if you're braising with water?
I'd recommend that that pot was packed with ingredients. So if you have only so much ingredients and you put them in a gigantic vessel, then it's going to be hard to get a very flavorful braise.
Well, if you're choosing a liquid, does that depend on the kind of meat that you're cooking?
Well, yeah. I mean, it depends.
For example, let's say you have a cut of meat that is really tough normally, and you're braising it because it's going to become nice and tender. Would something with alcohol, like wine or beer, help break down the toughness?
No, the alcohol wouldn't have an effect on the toughness. It's just the liquid. If you're braising beef, I would go with a red wine, not a white wine, because we're looking for certain flavors, or a beer braise for a pot roast, say.
Mm-hmm. Is it important to have some kind of thickener in this?
Often it is, and I love just a simple beurre manier, which is in French kneaded butter, and you knead flour into butter until it's a paste, and you can just add it until your sauce is thick enough.
You can also use cornstarch?
You can use a slurry of equal parts cornstarch and water.
Now, but you prefer combining the flour with fat for thickening. Butter mostly? Ever use schmaltz?
Schmaltz works great, too. It's very flavorful.
You've done a bit of writing about schmaltz.
The book of schmaltz, absolutely.
What does it take to make a roux? It's always looked like it was something that only a French chef should be doing.
It's a matter of putting equal parts butter and flour into a pan and cooking it till it's a paste.
But you clarified butter?
Clarified butter classically, but it doesn't have to be. I just use whole butter. It's fine.
My guest is Michael Ruhlman, whose latest book is Ruhlman's How to Braise, Foolproof Techniques and Recipes for the Home Cook. It's published by Little Brown and Company. You talk about two secret ingredients. Honey. When do you add the honey? From the start?
You add it to the liquid when you put it all together and before it goes into the oven. Mm-hmm. Something about honey just really rounds out the flavor. This I learned from a Cleveland chef, and he's absolutely right. I always add honey to a rich braise.
How much honey are we talking about? A spoonful?
Yeah, a tablespoon or two for a pot.
And then you also say Asian fish sauce.
I love Asian fish sauce. It adds a real depth of flavor, the umami that we talk about, without adding fishiness. You can add it to mac and cheese. I add it to all these stews for even more depth of flavor.
So people are confused because it says fish sauce?
Why would you put fish sauce in a beef stew?
Or a macaroni and cheese.
Or a macaroni and cheese, for that matter. Because it's got an effect like salt. It deepens and enriches all the flavors.
And can I find that at any supermarket?
Yeah, you should. It's widely available. Oh.
I've always worried that the one in the supermarket would not be as good as the one in the Asian food store.
There are varying qualities of fish sauce. This is true.
What about oven temperature? Are we talking about slow cooking here?
We are talking about slow cooking. The perfect braise temperature, I believe, is 300 degrees. But if you wanted to do it lower and slower, you could go as low as 250.
And then you say, do it until it is fork tender, because each piece of meat will have its individual quality. Now, what does fork tender meat mean? When I put the fork in, it starts pulling away easily?
It means that the meat offers no resistance when you put a fork into it.
Why do certain foods taste better when they're chilled and then reheated? Does that apply to braised stuff?
Almost all braises it applies to, all meat braises it applies to. Somehow the cooling and ripening of these flavors does affect it. It's much better to do a braise a day or two in advance.
With your classic pot roast, after you have softened vegetables in bacon fat, you also add a quarter cup of tomato paste. Mm-hmm. And that just deepens the flavor?
Deepens the flavor, adds sweetness and color.
And what would you be using as a liquid in that?
You could use anything. For a classic pot roast, I like to use beef stock and some wine. But you could use all wine. You could use all water. You could use beer. You could use, you know.
Water and wine. Water and wine, beer.
Yeah.
Do you turn the roast over in the pot while it's cooking?
That's up to the cook. If part of the roast is exposed to air and is drying out, I would flip it.
How does a classic pot roast differ from a Yankee pot roast?
Yankee pot roast typically includes the vegetables that will be served along with the meal. So you'd add potatoes and carrots and onions late in the cooking so they didn't dissolve into mush, and cook them till they were tender.
I'm suddenly thinking about milk as another liquid. Is there any meat that you might want to cook milk with?
Yeah, pork is a great
thing. So you're already not kosher, so it doesn't matter.
Right. You could braise beef and milk, I suppose.
Chicken thighs also are pretty good for braising.
Oh, they're the best for braising. Bone-in, skin-on chicken thighs are great for braising. Economical cut. You don't have to braise them for hours and hours. It's a beautiful thing to cook.
And in the book, you give us two versions. We have the coq au vin style, although there's also a Thai green curry sauce. Are bacon lardons the secret ingredient here?
I use the bacon lardons in the Thai version. But yes, absolutely, in the coq au vin.
And you use a parchment lid?
I use a parchment lid which keeps some moisture in, allows some evaporation, and keeps some of the heat in without allowing the mixture to come to a boil. When you cover a pot, it's going to boil, and that sort of rolls all the meat and vegetables around in the fragment.
We have a number of recipes on our show page, fennel pot roast and chicken thighs, coq au vin style. A listener, Catherine, called in. She says she's part Greek, and she uses olive oil and rolled oats that she grinds up for a roux, and she says it's great.
Fascinating. I believe that would work, and I've never heard of that, and something I'll have to try.
And Tom in California asks about making carnitas. They're great to braise, but how do you get the crispness?
You'd get the crispness from heavy sear at the outset.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you take the braised meat and then sear it again afterward?
That would be a great strategy as well, yeah.
A caller wanted to know what you think about using guar gum as a thickening agent.
I know of it. I've never used it. I'm sure it's fine. I stick to the traditional easily available ingredients.
Now, getting back to fennel, that's the first vegetable that you used?
That was the first vegetable I ever braised.
Really?
At the Culinary Institute of America, yeah.
Was that something that they had you do?
Yeah.
To show you that fennel, which is a very misunderstood vegetable, actually can be delicious?
It can be very delicious when braised, especially if you get a nice sear on it. It's beautiful to look at. It becomes tender and delicious. It's a great vegetable.
Do you have special pots that you use for braising?
I love to use cast iron and enamel. Dutch ovens are the best.
Mm-hmm.
But you can braise in anything you want. If you just have a steel pot, you can do a braise in that, or you can do it in a cast iron skillet.
And then what happens with the leftover braising liquid? Do you use that like the equivalent of a stock?
You certainly shouldn't throw it away. Absolutely. I would save it and add it to the next braise, and the next braise will be even better. It freezes great.
Use it in risotto?
Ooh, that's a good idea. I hadn't thought of that.
This is your second technique book. The first one was about roasting.
Mm-hmm.
There are a whole bunch of other techniques. Should I expect to see a few of them in the future?
You should. The next out will be how to sauté and how to grill.
Uh-huh. Because grilling will be coming up very soon once we get past the snow. March the 20th is the first day of spring.
It's hard to believe.
Some of the other great recipes included in the book are beef brisket carbonade, wine braised beef short ribs. Short ribs used to be a really inexpensive cut of meat, and now they're incredibly expensive if you can find them. What happened?
I think they became popular. People realized how good they were, and so butchers could charge more money for them.
Ida's beef stew is also here, overnight pulled pork, braised cabbage.
I love braised cabbage, especially with corned beef. My wife makes braised cabbage and corned beef on St. Paddy's Day.
Michael Ruhlman started writing about the lives of chefs 20 years ago, and he soon became interested in training as a chef himself. After his success with the narrative books, The Making of a Chef, The Soul of a Chef, and The Reach of a Chef, he started employing his own skills in cooking to write cookbooks of his own, reference books, including Ratio, The Elements of Cooking, Charcuterie, and Egg. And now we have Ruhlman's How to Braise, Foolproof Techniques and Recipes for the Home Cook, with photographs by your wife, I assume.
Yes.
Donna Turner Ruhlman, beautiful photographs, published by Little Brown and Company. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.